Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov, depending where you are. It's a pleasure to see everybody. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Ari Mermelstein, as we say, for his debut on Torah in Motion. And like I mentioned, I do want to thank Dr. Aaron Kohler, who recommended, who made our shidduch. Dr. Mermelstein is the Associate Professor of Bible and Second Temple Literature at Yeshiva University and Chair of the Department of Bible, Hebrew, and Near Eastern Studies at Yeshiva College, where he's been teaching since 2007 and was twice voted the William and Lillian Silver Professor of the Year at Yeshiva College. He is also a JD, a lawyer from NYU Law School, the Assistant Director of the YU Center for Jewish Law and Contemporary Civilization. So it's author of a number of books. So it's really a pleasure to welcome you. And we're looking forward to this three-part series, understanding, I guess, the rituals of Pesach through the prism of the historian. B'vakasha, Dr. Mermelstein, it's all yours.
Good morning, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here. Jay, thank you so much for inviting me to present. As Jay said, this is going to be the first in a series of three shiurim. I think that we can consider this morning's and next week's shiurim to be sort of a pair. I think that what we're going to see is a degree of continuity between what I'm going to speak about this morning and what I will speak about next Wednesday. And we'll talk about how the third shiur in this series, which will take place in 2 weeks, is a natural outgrowth of the first two. So let me introduce the general direction in which I want to take the topic, and then I'll share my screen and we can get started with the sources. The basic dilemma that Jews had to deal with in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple. So just so that we can orient ourselves chronologically, the Second Temple is built in the year 515 BCE and is destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 CE. The basic dilemma that Jews face in the year 70 CE is what exactly their religious life is going to look like. After all, the temple was the locus of the divine presence. It was the centerpiece of Jewish ritual worship during that nearly 600-year period. And so it wasn't obvious exactly how Jews would recover from the trauma of the destruction. And I think that the sense of trauma, I think, is... I think that the sense of trauma is conveyed in a very poignant way in the first source on the source sheet. Source sheets were posted. I've made a couple of tweaks to them. In any case, I'll share the screen so that we can all be on the same page. So you're welcome to look at the sources. Jay has just shared them. I'll also share them. As I said, I just moved a couple of things around, Jay. I hope that's okay. In any case, let me share my screen. And Jay, if you want, I'm happy to send you the updated, again, only slightly revised version of this.
All right. We can do that afterwards and we'll repost it. But in the meantime, you know, we'll people have to listen carefully and see what are the differences between the
two. Sure. Okay. So starting with the Tosefta and Sotan, I think that in many ways, this is the most poignant expression of just how much Jews struggled with the trauma of the destruction of the Second Temple. Misha Harava Bayit Ha'acharon. Rabu Purushim b'Yisrael. So after the destruction of the Second Temple, ascetics multiplied in Israel. Why is it that ascetics multiplied in Israel? So we discover from the rest of the Tosefta what exactly this asceticism was a response to. Shelo hayu ochlim basar v'lo shotin yayin. They refrained from eating meat and from drinking wine. Nitzpal lehen Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua, the great Tana, joined them and had the following conversation. Amar lehen, banai, Mipnei ma einatem ochlim basar. My children, why do you refrain from consuming meat? Amrulo, nochal basar, should we eat meat? Shebechol yom hayat hamid karev l'gabeh ha-mizbeach v'achshav batel. Every day during the long period of the Second Temple, we would bring the daily sacrifice made out of meat. We're no longer able to do so. How can we move on and continue consuming meat? So Rabbi Yehoshua responds and says, Amar len lo nochal. So fine, so we're not going to eat meat. Why do you refrain from drinking wine? Amrulo, yain nishte. Should we drink wine? Shebechol yom hayad mit nasech agabe hamizbeach ve'achshav batel. Every day there were wine libations brought on the mizbeach. We no longer can do that. Therefore, we shouldn't be drinking wine. Amar lahem lo nishte. Right? He concedes no more wine. Amar lahem. But then he proceeds and points out through sort of a reductio ad absurdum just how untenable their position is. Amar lahem imkein lechem lonochal. If it's true that we should refrain from eating and drinking certain foods because they were part of temple worship, we shouldn't eat bread. Shemimenu hayu mevi'in shtei halechem v'lechem apanim. Because after all, we have the sacrifice of the two loaves and the weekly showbread, both of which were made from bread. And so therefore, if bread was a staple of temple ritual worship, it shouldn't be part of our ongoing diet. And mayim lo nishta, we also shouldn't be drinking water. Shemehen hayu minastin mayim bechav, because there was the ritual of the water libations on Sukkot. Te'inim va'anavim lo nochal, we also shouldn't be consuming figs and grapes. Shemehem hayu mevi'im bikurim ba'atzeret, because on Shavuot, they would bring the fruits, the first fruit offering. And so therefore, not only should we refrain from eating meat and drinking wine, but according to your logic, we basically should starve ourselves, shatku. And they recognized the absurdity of their arguments. And so he goes on and offers a more productive path forward for Jews who were still suffering from that trauma. Amar lahem, banai, lihitabel yoter midai yefshar. It's impossible. We cannot mourn excessively. Bishalo lihitabel yefshar. But we also need to mourn partially. So therefore, what did the rabbis advise? Goes through a series of practices that the rabbis advised in order to hold on to the memory of the temple, what he calls Zecher Yerushalayim. And so the way that we build our homes, the way that we celebrate our joyous occasions should all be tinged with a certain degree of sadness in response to the destruction. It's what Rabbi Yehoshua refers to as Zecher Yerushalayim. Zecher Yerushalayim means we cannot recapture what we had during the time of the Second Temple. It's just not possible to go back. We therefore need to blaze a path forward while also realizing that there is something missing. But this is Rabbi Yehoshua's response to the trauma. Our path forward is not simply to be paralyzed, but rather it's to preserve the memory through these regular daily practices, but basically token practices that will just raise to consciousness what it is that we're missing. And that's what Rabbi Yehoshua refers to as Zecher Yerushalayim. I bring this source first because I think it really conveys very clearly the degree of trauma and the degree of loss. There were other possible paths forward for the Jews, and I think that this other possible path forward is what we find reflected in the next source that we're going to look at from the Mishnah and Sukkah. In the beginning, lulav was the lulav and etrog were taken in the Beit HaMikdash all 7 days. And outside of the Beit HaMikdash, only one day. Misha'charav Beit HaMikdash, hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, sheyehi lulav nital b'medina shiva zecher l'mikdash. After the destruction of the Second Temple, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai decreed that the lulav, which until that point had only been taken for one day outside of the Beit HaMikdash, should be taken all 7 days. The formulation that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai uses is not Zecher Yerushalayim, which is what we saw previously in the Tosefta. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai refers to this proposed practice, Zecher LaMikdash. The difference is that Zecher LaMikdash basically is a way of perpetuating practices that were part of temple ritual into the post-second temple period. Zecher LaMikdash means there was a practice, for example, in this case, of bringing the lulav and the etrog 7 days in the Beit HaMikdash. We can continue doing that after the destruction of the temple. And so therefore, let's do everything that we can not to blaze a path forward, which is what Rabbi Yehoshua was arguing, which is what that category of Zecher Yerushalayim represents. Small, but substantial and regular practices that will allow us to commemorate what we're missing. What Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is proposing is let's hold on to the past in whatever way we can by perpetuating in the present what we had in the time of the temple. It's a different sort of direction in which to take Judaism after the destruction of the Second Temple. Of course, the the problem that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's solution is going to face is that typically there's a limited range of possible temple practices that can be perpetuated in the aftermath of destruction. Because after all, most of the practices of temple ritual focused on sacrifice. Sacrifice was an impossibility after the destruction, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's solution, while creative, is going to be relatively limited in scope. What I want to do now, this is what we're going to talk about for the rest of today's shiur, is to think about the evolution of the Seder and of our practices on the night of the Seder through the lens of what we've just discussed. The Jews have experienced the trauma of the destruction in the year 70 CE. The Korban Pesach was unique in several respects. The Korban Pesach was primarily unique in that it was the one sacrifice that all Jews were obligated to bring at this one moment. And it was the one sacrifice that was not necessarily going to be offered on the altar as a sacrifice that was independent of the altar. And as a sacrifice that was a personal obligation for all Jews, it was of all of the possible sacrifices, the greatest candidate for something like what we see in Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. If we're going to adopt some sort of possibility of perpetuating sacrificial worship from the temple into the post-Second Temple period, the Korban Pesach was going to be at least the prime possibility. And the first set of sources that we're going to look at are basically building upon this approach of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Let's take what we can outside of simply lulav and etrog, but let's take what we can from actual sacrificial worship and see if it's possible for us to continue offering it into the post-Second Temple period. This is a practice that we'll see is referred to in a number of sources, mostly from Tanaitic literature, as the Gedi Mikulas. Now, even before we get to the Gedi Mikulas, it's important to appreciate just how significant the Korban Pesach was to the ritual on the night of the 15th of Nisan. This is the psukim from Sefer Shmot that describe the Korban Pesach, the first bringing of the Korban Pesach. V'yachlu, you have the English alongside the Hebrew, so I'll just read the Hebrew. V'yachlu et habasar balayla hazeh, tzli'e shumatzot al merorim yofluhu, al toflu mimenu na, uvashel mevushal b'mayim, ki'im tzli'esh rosho al kra'a v'al kirbo. It's clear from those psukim and from the subsequent passage that the Korban Pesach, the sacrifice, is the centerpiece of the ritual. There are these accompanying foods, the matzot and the merorim, but the matzot and merorim are here simply accompaniments. They're not the center of the ritual. In a few psukim later, when the Torah says, one day your child will ask you, maha avodah hazot lachem, what is this ritual in which you are engaging? And you're supposed to answer your child, va'amartem zevach pesach hu lashem. This is the Korban Pesach that we bring to God. So it's clear that the meat itself, the Korban, was at the core of the ritual. Now, at the same time that it was at the core of the ritual, it's possible that there were Jews outside of Jerusalem, outside of the temple, who were already bringing some sort of sacrifice during the Second Temple period itself. So I want to just take a look at this passage from Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria is a Jew living in Alexandria in Egypt, probably sometime in the last quarter of the first century BCE into, let's call it, around the year 50 CE, somewhere in that range. He's a prolific author, left us a massive corpus, mostly of biblical interpretation in Greek. This is a small excerpt from his work called Special Law. Special Laws is Philo's explication of the halachic portions of the Torah. And he has this to say in describing the Korban Pesach. He writes, on this day, every dwelling house is invested with the outward semblance and dignity of a temple. The victim is then slaughtered and dressed for the festal meal, which befits the occasion. The guests assembled for the banquet have been cleansed by purificatory lustrations and are there not as in other festive gatherings to indulge the belly with wine and meats, but to fulfill with prayers and hymns the custom handed down by their fathers. So what's interesting about this passage in Philo, and this is what has at least piqued the interest of historians, is that it's not clear that Philo is simply describing his understanding of what takes place in Jerusalem. When he talks about every dwelling house, it seems that Philo might be alluding to the practice in his hometown of Alexandria. And what he's saying here is that in every dwelling house, there is the dignity of the temple, which doesn't mean that they're bringing a sacrifice, but it does mean that in the second sentence, when he refers to the victim as being slaughtered and dressed for the festal meal, what he's suggesting is that even outside of the temple, even outside of Jerusalem, even outside of Israel, there is a sense in which the meat that they consume on this night is a surrogate in some ways, a substitute for the Korban Pesach that is being brought in Jerusalem. And so therefore the house itself takes on the quality of a temple, the dignity of a temple, and they speaks about the slaughtering of a victim, the slaughtering of an animal, which is understood to be sort of a substitute for Korban Pesach. He goes on and he says that what they're supposed to be doing on this night is they are supposed to be, as on all other festive gatherings, they're supposed to be not simply eating wine and meat, but also reciting prayers and hymns. If in fact this is a reflection of Philo's local practice, it also means that aside from consuming this meat, he's also reciting prayers and hymns. Notice what's missing is the idea of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, of telling the story. It's likely that presumably while sitting around and consuming this meat that they were recounting the events of the past, but at least what Philo focuses on here are prayers and hymns, right? What we might describe as Hallel, which of course is an important part of our Seder. But for Philo, there is the possibility of eating meat, if in fact that's the way to read this, outside of Israel. That meat might take on a certain sacrificial quality, and it's associated with the consumption of a Korban Pesach. But the question is, so it's associated with the practice of Hallel. Question is, though, what happens after the destruction of the temple? Is it so obvious that maybe what Philo is describing here as sort of the embracing of a quasi-sacrificial ritual, is that going to pass muster for Jews after the temple has been destroyed? So that's the subject of a couple of Tanaitic sources, mostly focused on Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel is going to be the key figure both in today's shiur and in next week's shiur, because Rabban Gamliel becomes associated with three primary practices on the night of the Seder. What we're going to see now is he's associated with a practice known as the eating of a Gedi Mikulas, which we'll talk about in a moment. We'll translate Gedi Mikulas as a helmeted kid with a helmet. He's associated with the ascription of symbolism to the various foods that we eat, so the Pesach, to the Matzah, and the Maror. And he's also associated with the practice of learning Hilchot HaPesach. That's going to be the subject of next week's shiur. Today, we're going to talk about the first of those two practices, eating this helmeted kid and ascribing symbolism to the foods at the Seder. So the Mishnah in Beitzah is our starting point for Rabban Gamliel's practice. And it says that Rabban Gamliel was Mekel. He adopted lenient positions in relation to three specific practices. For now, we're only interested in the third of them. The third of these practices is that he would make osin gidim mikulas bilele psachim v'chachamim osrim. He would do something called a gidim mikulas, something that is described in this mission as characterized as a kula, namely it's a leniency in some regard. The chachamim, the sages in general, prohibited this kind of a practice, and the question is why. So in order to understand why this was objectionable, we need to take a step back and understand how the Korban Pesach itself was prepared. So the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai describes the practice of the mode of preparation of the Korban Pesach. The pasuk that the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is commenting on, and I think this is one of the tweaks that I made. I think this was at an earlier point on the original source sheet. I've moved it to this point. The pasuk in the Mechilta, he is commenting on the pasuk from Sefer Shemot that we read before. Ki im tzli esh rosho al kra'av yal kirbo. The Korban Pesach is roasted, head, legs, and entrails over the fire. So the question is, what exactly does that mean when it speaks about the head, legs, and entrails? Where do those go in relation to the animal? And so that's the subject of a machloket in the Mechilta, the debate between Rabbi Yossi HaGlili and Rabbi Akiva. According to Rabbi Yosef HaGlili, Hayame vi et rosho vi et kra'av vi et b'nei me'av l'tocho. Rabbi Yosef HaGlili says that the way that the Korban Pesach was prepared was that they would basically put in all of the extremities into the inside of the animal, so that basically the parts of the animal that typically would be outside of the animal we're now inside of the animal. Rabbi Akiva describes the process differently. He says, Afhein nechmarim umitbashlin mitocho, ela tolin chutzalo. While it's true that the intestines, the entrails, were in fact cooked inside of the animal, when it came to actually preparing it, they would actually wrap the entrails around the head of the animal. And therefore, according to Rabbi Yishmael, the Korban Pesach was known as a Gedi Mikulas. Because if you looked at the way that a Korban Pesach appeared, the Korban Pesach appeared like an animal that had a helmet on its head, where the helmet was produced by the entrails. So that's what's known as a Gedi Mikulas. Okay, adopting Rabbi Akiva's position that the entrails, the way to read Rosho al Kra'avi al Kirbo, is that the intestines were wrapped around the top of the head. So that when Rabban Gamliel says that, when Rabban Gamliel is said to have brought a Gedi Mikulas Belelei Psachim, the reason that that's a controversial practice, presumably, is because that was the mode of preparation for the Korban Pesach itself. So what Rabban Gamliel is proposing is that a Gedi Mikulas can be prepared and eaten in that exact way outside of the Beit HaMikdash. He's not simply proposing that you can eat roasted meat on the night of the 15th of Nisan. What he's saying is we can actually eat an animal prepared in the exact same way. That's the basis for the controversy between Rabban Gamliel and the Chachamim. And you can understand why that would have been objectionable, because as we'll see in a moment, the way that that was characterized was it looks like you are eating kodshim bachutz, looks like you are preparing and eating sacrificial meat outside of the Beit HaMikdash. But what we have other sources that seem to attest similar kind of practice for Rabban Gamliel. And if what we just read in the Mishnah is that Rabban Gamliel said that it was acceptable to eat a Gedi Mikulas in that way, there's some evidence that Rabban Gamliel himself might have consumed such a Gedi Mikulas. The Mishnah in Pesachim writes as follows, Ein solin et ha-pesach lo al ha-shapud v'lo al ha-askala. According to the Mishnah, you're not permitted to roast a Korban Pesach on a metal spit or on a metal grill. The idea being that the Torah says that it has to be tzli esh. It has to be roasted directly over the fire. And if you're cooking it on a metal spit or a metal grill, then it's possible that it's being cooked not directly by the fire, but secondarily from the heat generated by the metal. Amar Rabbi Tzadok, Ma'aseh Berabban Gamliel, Sha'amar Latavi Avdo, Say utzleilanu et ha-pesach al ha-askala. Rabban Gamliel is recalled to have told his servant Tavi that Tavi should go and roast a Pesach on the askala, on this metal grill. So the Talmud Yerushalmi understands that the reason that the Mishnah is quoting this episode is precisely to show that Rabban Gamliel disagreed with the position that you could not bring a Pesach on an askala. It was acceptable to bring a Pesach on some sort of a metal grill. But what's important for our purposes is understanding who this Rabban Gamliel is. There are some commentators on the Mishnah who say this is Rabban Gamliel the first. We know that there was one Rabban Gamliel, known as Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, who lived during the time of the Second Temple. If this is that Rabban Gamliel, then all that he's saying to his servant Tavi is, we're in Yerushalayim, let's bring the Korban Pesach. You can roast that Korban Pesach on this askala. In which case, there isn't anything especially remarkable about this. There's simply a machloket about whether you can bring a Korban Pesach on a metal grill or not. But the interesting consideration here is that it seems that this is not Rabban Gamliel the first, Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, who lived during the time of the Second Temple, but rather his grandson, Rabban Gamliel the second, that's the Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. And the reason for thinking that this is Rabban Gamliel the second, so that is Rabban Gamliel, who is more famous in his activities after the destruction of the Second Temple, is because that Rabban Gamliel is the one associated with Tevi. When in other sources we find Tavi Avdo, Shal Rabban Gamliel, it's typically the second Rabban Gamliel. And we know that because that Rabban Gamliel and his servant Tavi are often associated with Tanaim of that generation, of Tanaim who postdated the temple. In which case, if that's the Rama Gamliel that we're talking about, it may be that what Rama Gamliel is saying to Tevi Avdo here is, Tevi, we're going to bring a Gedim Mikulas, a practice that we just saw Rama Gamliel permitted. I want you to bring a Gedim Mikulas, and he refers to it as a Pesach. Now, the Mishnah doesn't say that what Rama Gamliel is doing here is bringing a Gedim Mikulas, but if we put two and two together and conclude that this is the Rama Gamliel who postdates the temple, and we know about him that he permitted the bringing of a Gedim Mikulas, it's plausible to conclude that that's exactly what's being described here. And so the Mishnah, which said he allowed it, it turns out is actually a practice that Rabbi Gamliel himself adopted. Now, we know from other sources that that there was kind of vociferous opposition to this practice. We already saw that the Chachamim are said to have prohibited it, but they come out in much harsher terms in this passage in the Tosefta. Tosefta first opens by saying, what is a Gedim Mikulas? How do we define it? So the Tosefta says the Gedim Mikulas, which is the type of animal that we've been talking about, the Gedim Mikulas is prepared exactly as had the Korban Pesach been. It's roasted, it's kulot sali, rosho kra'avi kirbo, right? It's roasted with its intestines wrapped around its head. Bishel mimenu kol shehu, shalak mimenu kol shehu, ein zeh gedim mikulas. If you prepare it in any way other than by roasting, it forfeits its status as a gedim mikulas, because like the Korban Pesach, it had to be completely roasted. The Tosefta continues, osin gedim mikulas b'yom tov harishon u'b'yom tov ha'acharon shehachad. So Tosefta says, you could bring such a gedim mikulas, on Yom Tov Rishon or Yom Tov Ha'acharon, Egel Mikulas, B'Yom Tov Harishon Shal Pesach, Avalo Gedim Mikulas. You could bring an Egel Mikulas, a calf that was prepared this way, on the first part of the Yom Tov, but not a Gedim Mikulas. The Mishnah and the Tosefta goes on to describe a controversy involving such a Gedim Mikulas. Amar Rabbi Yosa, Todos Ish Romi, Inhig ebnei romi likach tzla'im b'leilei psachim ve'osin otan mikulasim. Rabbi Yossi refers to a practice of somebody named Todus Ish Romi, a Jew who lived in Rome, who instituted a practice among the Romans to bring a sheep on the night of Pesach and prepare it in this helmeted way, osin otan mikulasim. Amrulo, and they said to him, Afku karov la'achil kachim bachutz. What Rabbi Yossi, what Todus Ish Romi is doing, approximates bringing kachim bachutz, approximates bringing sacrificial meat outside of the Beit HaMikdash, not simply because he's eating meat prepared in this way, but because he's calling it a Pesach. Mipnei shekorin otam psachim. That's what was objectionable. Now, what's interesting about that is if we go back to the Mishnah that we just read, if in fact what's happening in this Mishnah in Psachim, when Rabbi Gamliel says to his servant Tevi, go and roast for us a Pesach, if that's referring actually to the bringing of a Gedim Mikulas, so then it's noteworthy that Rabbi Gamliel refers to that Gedim Mikulas as a Pesach. Sei utzleilanu et ha-Pesach. So the very practice that the Chachamim found objectionable, they said in the first Mishnah that we read, that it's prohibited to bring a Gedim Mikulas. And in the Tosefta that we just read, that it's prohibited to call a Gedim Mikulas a Pesach, it turns out Rabbi Gamliel adopted in both cases. He said it's permissible to bring a Gedim Mikulas, and it seems like he actually refers to it as a Pesach. So I start with this practice as in terms of how Jews responded to the absence of the Korban Pesach, because for this first type of response, this is something along the lines of what we saw in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his category of Zecher Lamikdash. What we have in Rabbi Gamliel's suggestion that we bring a Gedim Mikulas is basically a statement that we can perpetuate the practice of Korban Pesach even after the Second Temple has been destroyed. It may be that that had precedent already in practices such as that of the Alexandrian Jewish community, if that's the way that we read Philo, but it's also clear that it was controversial. Nonetheless, this was one possible way of expanding that sort of approach that we saw in Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and saying, we don't have to move on. We're going to move on. We're not going to be paralyzed, but at the same time, we can hold on to vestiges of the past wherever possible, the Korban Pesach being one such example. And interestingly enough, it seems there's evidence that the practice of Gedim Mikulas actually continued in Eretz Yisrael for centuries. This is a line from work that is known as Sefer Ma'asim Livnei Eretz Yisrael. Halachic work, a halachic compendium of practices of B'nai Eretz Yisrael, of people associated with Eretz Yisrael. It was found in the Cairo Geniza. What's very interesting about this particular passage is that it refers to the Gedim Mikulas. Gedim Mikulas, what is a Gedim Mikulas? Zenitzlah Shalem Rosho Al Kra'av Al Kirbo. So it adds one detail to the definition of a Gedim Mikulas that we saw before. Earlier, the Gedim Mikulas was simply described as a kid that is brought Rosho Al Kra'av Yakirbo, prepared in the familiar way as the Korban Pesach. Here, it's also described as being roasted shalem, which of course the Korban Pesach was. That would have been exceptional. You're not typically going to roast an entire kid shalem, whole. The fact that this line is found in a work of practical halacha for B'nai Eretz Yisrael suggests, and we don't know exactly when this is from, but it's probably no earlier than 6th century CE, 6th, 7th, 8th century CE. So we're talking about basically a text that reflects Jewish practice in Eretz Yisrael 400, 500 years after Rabbi Gamliel, 400, 500 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. And it seems that there are still Jews in Israel who are bringing a Gedim Mikulas. There are other hints to this practice elsewhere. The church father Jerome hints to the fact that there may also be Jews in his day who are eating sort of a quasi-Korban Pesach. But this would be kind of the latest example where we find this practice continuing in Eretz Israel. Okay, that's approach number one. That's the Zecher LaMikdash approach. That's the approach that says in the aftermath of destruction, we can still bring a quasi-Korban Pesach. Okay, approach number two, also associated with Rabbi Gamliel, is what we find in the Mishnah in Psachim Perek Yud Mishnah. This passage is incorporated into the Haggadah Shel Pesach, so it should be familiar. Again, the English is alongside the Hebrew, so feel free to read the English as I read in the Hebrew. Rabbi Gamliel haya omer, kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim elu b'fesach lo yatsa yidei chovato ve'elu hen pesach matza umaror. So you need to say the following three things. You need to provide symbolic explanation for those three foods, the Pesach, the Matzah, and the Maror. Pesach, al shum shepasach hamakom al batei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Matzah, al shum shenigalu avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Maror, al shum shemeru hamitzrim et chayei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Okay, so three symbolic reasons given for each of the three different foods. What's interesting about what Rabbi Gamliel is doing here, first of all, is that he's reducing the Pesach from something that you are supposed to eat. Its significance is the fact that you're supposed to eat it. It was a physical object for consumption. What Rabbi Gamliel is saying here is the primary significance of the Pesach is not simply its consumption, but rather what it symbolically represents. So what Rabbi Gamliel is doing is subtly shifting the focus away from this ritual focused on the korban itself, and saying that even in the absence of a korban, we still have the symbolic significance of the Pesach. And since that's what's important about the consumption of the Pesach, even in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, we haven't necessarily lost very much. So this is kind of a subtle shift. It's not simply saying we can perpetuate the practices of the past and eat the Korban Pesach in the present. What he's saying is the significance of the Korban Pesach all along was not that it was a food per se, but it was what it symbolically represented. We want to put these two practices of Rabbi Gamliel together, the practice of eating the Gedim Mikulas and the practice of reciting or ascribing certain symbolic significance to the Korban Pesach, what you begin to see is that kind of collectively, Rav Gamliel is saying, look, we can, on the one hand, continue eating that Korban Pesach, and at the same time, we can say its importance was never really as a food for consumption. Its importance primarily is for what it symbolically represents. So there's part of what Rav Gamliel is doing here, part of what he's doing is reducing or reorienting the practice away from the physical food and its consumption toward its symbolic significance. That's part of what he does. But the second piece of what he does is he focuses not only on the Pesach, but also on the matzah and the maror. Recall what I said earlier, that according to the Torah, the Korban Pesach is brought al matzot umarorim. It's accompanied by the matzah and the maror. And when the Torah does in some way ascribe some sort of symbolism to the Korban, to the actual Korban Pesach, it doesn't ascribe any additional significance to the matzah and the maror. It simply refers to it as one large avodah. So in ascribing separate symbolic significance to the matzah and the maror, what Rav Gamliel is doing here is going beyond the Korban Pesach and saying that in addition to the Korban Pesach, there are these other two foods. Those two foods were there during the time of the Beit HaMikdash. We obviously can continue eating them, but he's elevating the significance of those foods beyond where they were during the time of the Beit HaMikdash by treating them separately and ascribing separate symbolic significance to them. So this too is a way of responding to the loss of the Korban Pesach by saying we've lost the Korban Pesach, but we can still do a Gedim Mikulas. And even the Gedim Mikulas is important simply for its symbolism. But aside from that, we also have the Matzah and the Maror, whose importance was there in the past as something symbolic, and therefore it's also something that we can continue into the present. I think that you really appreciate just how radical this move was by Rav Gamliel by looking in a different version of the same Mishnah. Because what we'll see from the different version of the same Mishnah is that it's not simply that now what Rav Gamliel has done is put these three foods on a level playing field. Elevated matzah and maror, and now they're on the same level as a Pesach. I think what Rav Gamliel is actually doing is elevating the matzah above the Pesach entirely. The text that we're going to look at is from a manuscript of the Mishnah known as the Kaufman manuscript. Now, the Kaufman manuscript is regarded as the most outstanding manuscript of the Mishnah. We have manuscripts of the Mishnah that were preserved primarily in Italy and Eretz Israel, where they continued learning Mishnah independent of the Talmudim, and so they preserved the text of the Mishnah much more precisely. You have on the right the printed version of the Mishnah. On the left, you have the Kaufman manuscript of the Mishnah. So let's take a look at the differences. So Rav Gamliel on the left opens in a similar way. The one difference that I already want to draw attention to is the fact that Rav Gamliel in the Kaufman manuscript on the left refers to not Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, but Pesach, Matzah, and Marorim. It's important just to observe that subtle difference, because what it suggests is that Rav Gamliel has in mind that Pasuk that we referred to earlier, Al Matzot Umarorim Yochlu, by referring to the Maror not as Maror, but as Marorim. That explains why it is that you end up having in our text of the, The reason that he lists it in that order, Pesach, Matzah, and Marorim, is he's simply following the order of the Pasuk. The Pesach, Al Matzot, Umarorim. But that's why it's interesting that when he gives the symbolic significance of the three foods in the Kaufman manuscript, he doesn't give the order as Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. He gives the order as Pesach, Maror, and Matzah. Notice the transposition of the Matzah and the Maror in the Kaufman manuscript. Here it's Pesach, right? And the significance is the same. But in Kaufman, it's Matzah al Shum Shenigalu as last. So that's one really significant discrepancy between the printed Mishnah and the Kaufman manuscript. The other critical difference between them, between the Kaufman manuscript, which is generally regarded as the more authentic version than the printed version, is the fact that the Kaufman manuscript lacks the passage B'chol Dor Vador. B'chol Dor Vador, which of course is present in our Haggadah as well. This is the sequence that we're familiar with from our Haggadah. Rav Gamliel, Then we go to Bechol Dor Vardor, Chayav Adam Lirodet Atzmo Kihu Yatzam Mitzrayim. In every generation, one is obligated to see oneself as having left Egypt. And we then go on to Hallel, Lefichach Anachnu Chayavim Lahodot LaHallel. Right? We're obligated to praise God and express thanksgiving. What you have in the Kaufman manuscript is you have a sequence that goes straight from Matzah Al Shum Shenigalu. Matzah is significant because it represents our redemption. That leads directly into Hallel. What happens, what I'm suggesting Rabbi Gamliel is doing here is Rabbi Gamliel is saying matzah is actually the most significant food that we consume at the night of the Seder. That's why he puts matzah last in the order in the Kaufman manuscript. And that's why matzah leads directly into Hallel. The reason that we recite Hallel in the original version of the Mishnah is not in response to the fact that in every generation we are supposed to see ourselves as having left Egypt. The reason that we recite Hallel, according to the Mishnah in its original version, is as a response to the matzah food, which symbolizes our redemption. So if, in fact, the Kaufman manuscript represents the more authentic version of the Mishnah, then what we have is Rabbi Gamliel not simply leveling the playing field and saying Pesach is simply significant because of what it symbolizes. And Maror and Matzah are likewise now elevated in stature because of their symbolic significance. What Rabbi Gamliel has actually done is Rabbi Gamliel has actually elevated Matzah to the status of being the most important of them. That's why he puts Matzah last. And that's why Matzah is the one that leads directly into Hallel, right? It's what provokes us to thank God for the Exodus. What has happened in the printed Mishnah, how exactly this gets lost in the printed Mishnah, this last piece of it, that he's actually elevating the matzah above the other foods. You only appreciate that when you see that it's last and that it leads directly into Hallel. What's happened in the printed Mishnah is that when Bechol Dor Vador, when the passage in the paragraph about seeing oneself as having left Egypt, when that gets inserted into the Mishnah, and it likely gets inserted for one of two reasons, either because that becomes the practice, that paragraph becomes common practice. And so the common practice gets inserted back into the Mishnah. That's likely what's happened here. When that passage gets inserted back into the Mishnah, you then lose you lose the natural connection between matzah and Hallel, because now Hallel is actually in response not to the matzah. Hallel is actually in response to the fact that we're supposed to see ourselves in every generation as having left Egypt. Once matzah is not understood as leading into Hallel, the order of the foods is simply shifted, Pesach, matzah, and maror, to conform to the order of the foods stated in Rabbi Gamliel's original line, Elohein, Pesach, matzah, and maror, which is also the sequence of the foods as found in that pasuk. So the introduction of this Bechol Dor Vador passage into the Mishnah subsequently at some later point is what has caused the symbolism of the foods to be the order to be shifted, which also causes us to lose a sense of just how radical a move Rabbi Gamliel has made. Okay, that's second kind of response to the destruction. Second response to the destruction is not let's continue perpetuating the practices of the past into the present. Second response is we can actually subtly shift the focus so that we focus not on the consumption of the food, but rather on what it symbolized. We can always appreciate the symbolism even into the future. There's a third response, and this third response is, I think, what is reflected in the earlier two Mishnayot in that same paragraph. So let's take a look at those earlier Mishnayot. Rabbi Gamliel was not, we only had Rabbi Gamliel in a vacuum. We wouldn't necessarily know where exactly he is reciting that passage, where it is that he's ascribing symbolic significance to the foods. We don't have him embedded within an entire Seder ritual in a vacuum. The Seder ritual is what is described in the previous two Mishnayot. Previous two Mishnayot begin as follows. Heviu lifanav mitabel bachazeret ad shemagia lifarperet hapat. Okay, so what is happening there? What are they bringing? what is this reference to dipping, and what is the parparet hapat? So in order just to understand that first line, which will be significant for reasons that we'll come to in a few minutes, we need to understand what a meal in general looked like in Eretz Israel at that time. In order to understand what a meal in general looked like in Eretz Israel, we need to look at the following Tosefta in Brachot, which describes such meals. What the Tosefta in Brachot describes basically is a process. Seder Seudah, this wasn't necessarily a typical meal, but a meal on some sort of festive occasion. People would come into some sort of waiting area. When they arrived in the waiting area, they would wash one of their hands. At that point, they would be given a cup of wine, and then they would be given parpraot. Parpraot are appetizers, and this was a familiar practice from the Greco-Roman world in general. The way in which meals, on joyous occasions, progressed was there was first a sequence of appetizers, here known as parpraot or parparet. After eating the parpraot, one would then progress to the actual meal itself. What's interesting about the Tosefta is the Tosefta says there wasn't only one parparet, there were actually three parpraot. And therefore it says, haba achar shalosh parpraot, ein lo reshut likanes. If you came to the meal after the three appetizers had been consumed, they didn't let you in. So that's when we talk about in the Mishnah that we just read, when the Mishnah that we just read says that they would bring before the people at the Seder something. And in general, the assumption is that the Heviu Lefanav, what they're bringing to the person seated at the Seder, is probably the Chazeret, probably the lettuce that is then described in the third and fourth words. Probably what this is referring to is that series of appetizers that was typically eaten at every festive meal. And you actually have a very interesting Haggadah from Eretz Yisrael that illustrates clearly that the sequence of the Seder was not that they would simply dip what we have as karpas and then move on from there. They actually had a sequence of such appetizers. So I'm just going to share my screen. This is one of the sources. This is one of the sources that that I added that I did not include previously. What's interesting here is you have, this is a Haggadah that includes a series of brachot before they ever come to the second phase. So after they wash Netilat Yadayim, and then they said, this is a Haggadah from Eretz Israel that was published in the Haggadah by Daniel Goldschmidt 50 plus years ago. More than that. The first of the brachot, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Borei Pri Ha'adama. So that's the first bracha. They're reciting it on something that is grown in the ground. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Borei Pri Ha'etz. Something that grows on trees. And then they would make kind of a strange bracha achrona. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Bara Harim Uvkaot, V'natah Behem Etz Kol Peri, Baruch Atah Hashem Al Ha'aretz V'al Pri Ha'etz. The details of that are not our concern for now. There was then a third and fourth bracha that we were saying. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Borei Minei Ma'adanim. Borei Minei Ma'adanim is a bracha with which we're familiar from the Talmud Yerushalmi. Apparently, when they would eat eggs mixed with honey, they would make this bracha, Borei Minei Ma'adanim, which suggests that they weren't only eating foods grown in the ground, right? They weren't only eating fruit and vegetables. They were also eating things like eggs mixed with honey. And then there would be a special bracha achrona that they would recite in this. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Bara Minei Ma'adanim La'adein Bahem Nefashot Rabo, Baruch Atah Hashem Al Ha'aretz V'al Ha'ma'adanim. And then there was a fourth bracha that they would recite. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Borei Minei Nefashot. Borei Minei Nefashot, here, the bracha rishona that was recited on certain meats that they would eat according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, and that's followed by also a distinctive bracha achrona. What you see from here, and then it goes on from there directly to Manishtana. So what you see is that in Eretz Israel, there was this practice of eating not simply one parparet at the right, not just the chazeret, not just one thing that they would eat, but they would actually eat a sequence of appetizers leading up to the manishtana. And so that's what is being described here. Jay, you can see I'm back on the source sheet, right? Okay. What is being described then in this first line is that they would bring before the people seated at the Seder these appetizers, which here is referred to as the chazeret. The chazeret was a type of lettuce. It's going to appear in the Mishnah again on the second line. What we know about the chazeret, it's a type of lettuce, and elsewhere the Talmud Yerushalmi explains why they were using it for maror. They haven't yet gotten to maror in the Mishnah, but they used it for maror according to the Talmud Yerushalmi. This is another one of the sources that I added. The reason that they would eat the chazeret for maror, this form of lettuce, is ma chazeret tchilata matok v'sofamar. Chazeret, when you first begin eating it, is sweet and then begins to take on a sort of more bitter quality. That was the same sequence of events for our ancestors in Egypt. Initially, they were told, "Bimetav ha'aretz hoshev et avicha v'yatachecha." Yosef is told by Paro, bring your father and your brothers down and allow them to dwell here in Egypt. That's the sweet part of the story, the acharkach by maruat chayehem babo dakashan. Later comes the bitter part. So according to the Yerushalmi, chazeret, this lettuce, was the best possible candidate for maror, because maror is not simply about bitterness. It's about the movement from sweet to bitter. In any case, the first of the appetizers that's brought is the chazeret, and the chazeret is being dipped. In the ancient world, in the Greco-Roman world, and in Eretz Yisrael as well, these appetizers that are brought at the beginning of the meal are always accompanied by dipping. And you eat these appetizers according to this first line in the Mishnah, ad shemagia lifarperet hapat. Now, what is parperet hapat? So we already saw the word parperet refers to these appetizers. The parperet hapat probably refers to the last of the appetizers that immediately precedes the main meal, because that was the sequence. Parpraot before the meal, and what we know from the Mishnah elsewhere, and we're not looking at the Mishnah, Mishnah Brachot, is there were also parpraot after the meal. And so that's, you're eating the sequence of appetizers up until the parperet. Three appetizers were typically eaten according to the Tosefta that we looked at before. According to the Haggadah, at the night of the Seder, there were four of them. Then what happens is, once you've consumed these appetizers, Heviu lifanav matza v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tavshilin afal pi she'en charoset mitzvah. Having then moved on from the parpraot, what we expect will happen is we expect now to move on to the main course, because that was the way in which festive meals always progressed. But what happens instead, they bring before the people seated at the Seder matzah, chazeret with charoset, and shnei tavshilin. So what's interesting is you have the kind of return of the chazeret. We already finished with the chazeret. We're not expecting it to come back, because the appetizer portion of the meal has just concluded. And yet now what happens is we have the chazeret returning. That obviously is going to spark a question. What's the question going to be? The question is going to be, we just finished with the appetizers. We've already dipped once. We're typically going to dip appetizers once. We did that with the chazeret, which would have been a familiar form of appetizer. Why are we reintroducing the chazeret in the main part of the meal? So that would naturally have provoked a kind of response. And of course, that's why when we come to the manishtana, to the questions that we see subsequently in the Mishnah, the reason that we ask, in the original form of the Mishnah, it was, why on every other night do we dip once, but tonight we dip twice? The reason why that is a question is because they were always dipping once at the appetizer phase of the meal. But when they bring before those seated at the Seder the chazeret the second time, it already suggests to them that something unique is happening here. Something different, something out of the ordinary. So that's one kind of noteworthy piece of what is happening here. The chazeret here is being brought specifically in order to provoke this kind of a question. They're not only bringing before those seated the chazeret, this appetizer for a second time for some reason, with the charoset as the thing that they're dipping the appetizer into, they're also bringing before those seated shnei tavshilin, two cooked foods which were apparently roasted. Why are they bringing before us roasted food? We don't generally only eat roasted food. There are two pieces of meat, but both of them are roasted. Why is that? And why are we bringing before us matzah? We're typically used to eating not simply matzah, but all forms of bread. And so the people who are accustomed to a certain sequence and a certain content to their festive meals would naturally have wondered at what is happening here, right? There are a lot of moving parts and a lot that remains to be understood. Uvamikdash hayum mivi'in lefanav gufo shel Pesach. So at this point in time of the Mishnah, they're bringing before those seated the chazeret for the second time, the matzah, and the two cooked foods which are roasted. At the time of the Beit HaMikdash, this is where they would bring the gufo shel Pesach. This is where they would bring the Korban Pesach. We're going to come back to that line in a moment. We then move on to Mishnah Dalid. They would pour the second cup, v'chan habein shoel. And this is the point in time at which the child poses a question to the parent. And the question that the child poses to the parent, again, in the original form of the Mishnah, I have that later. You feel free to take a look at your leisure. But the three questions, not the four questions in the original Haggadah, there were three questions. The three questions, just take a quick look. I can't resist. The three questions in the original form of the Mishnah. And again, here we're looking at the better Mishnah manuscripts alongside the printed Mishnah manuscript. The three questions were, why do we dip once? Why do we dip twice tonight, whereas on all other nights we dip once? Why do we eat matzah tonight rather than also chametz and matzah? And why tonight are we only eating roasted food? Why were there only three questions in the original Mishnah and not four? Because those three questions are in response to the way in which this meal is now beginning to unfold. It's beginning to unfold with three foods having just been brought to the table. Matzah, the chazeret, this food that they dip, and the meat. And so that's why, in response to those things, the child now speaks up and says, wait, I don't understand what's happening. This sequence of events, the bringing of the foods, which provokes the child to ask these questions, I would suggest that this is now a third way in which the rabbis, in the aftermath of the destruction, responded to the loss of the Korban Pesach. What we have here is not simply, as we saw in Rabban Gamliel, where the foods now are being recognized simply for their symbolic significance. The foods are important, but what's important is not the foods as physical items, but rather their symbolism. What we have here is one step beyond that. What's important about the foods is simply their role as ritual props, P-R-O-P. They are ritual props that are meant to get to the main part of the night, which is not their consumption at all. The main part of the night is provoking this question by the child. It's the conversation that will ensue among the family. And so this is going one step beyond and saying, we did have these foods in the past. We did have the Korban Pesach. But even during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, the Korban Pesach's primary significance was simply in provoking questions. Notice the way in which the Korban Pesach is introduced in this Mishnah. It's kind of an afterthought. This is where it's at this point that we bring before those seated here, the matzah and the appetizer and the two roasted foods. And also at this point, this is where they would bring the gufo shel Pesach. As if there's nothing remarkable about the difference between the present time and the past. In both cases, the Korban Pesach then and the roasted meat that we substitute for it in the present was simply important for provoking this question on the part of the child, engaging in family conversation, and it's therefore through this total reimagining of the fest of the ritual of the past that we're able to now carry it forward to the present. This is not like Rabban Gamliel eating the Gedi Mikulas or even ascribing symbolic significance to the foods. This is the Mishnah, and although these are two Mishnayot that lead to Rabban Gamliel, I'm suggesting that they were separately regarded as two possible responses to the absence of the Korban Pesach. This is now diminishing the foods from physical items to simply ritual props that are meant to provoke conversation, which is really the centerpiece of the Korban Pesach, of the night. What we're going to do next week. So I'll take questions in 1 second. What we're going to do next week is we're going to move on to talk about a third response proposed by Rabban Gamliel to the absence of the Korban Pesach, not the Gedimi Kulas, not ascribing symbolic significance. What he will focus on, as we'll see next week, is actually the study of the halachot of the Korban Pesach, not even the Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is the direction in which those first two Mishnayot went, but something completely different. That will be the subject of our shiur next week. Okay, stop here. Let me take some questions. I'm just going to go from left to right on the top of my screen. Dennis Karpf.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent shiur. As a historian, could you say that somehow these three changes with the de-emphasis on the Korban Pesach is really designed to balance the responsibilities of liberty, moving away from the violence of overcoming slavery and the genocide from Egypt to a society that balances the need for violence in rare circumstances, but respect for life, both human, animal, and plant, considering how the creation of mankind was originally vegetarian after the flood and the first killing of Cain and Abel.
That's a very interesting suggestion. The only thing that I would say is, I think that's fascinating. The only thing that I would say is if that were the primary impetus, I would have expected something like that to develop earlier during the time of the Second Temple. The fact that this is a post-Second Temple phenomenon, that might be sort of the resulting way in which we explain it. But I think the fact that it's only in the aftermath of the destruction that we begin to see these sorts of approaches, I think I would prefer seeing it as a response to the absence of the Korban Pesach rather than the interesting direction in which you're taking it. But I appreciate the comment. Thank you. Bob Davis, Baltimore.
Yes. My understanding is during the Second Temple period, there was a difficulty with the Judeans, the people in Israel, in Jerusalem, and the people who had left Jerusalem after the first temple and went down to Egypt. The Egyptians tried to continue the practice without having to go back to the Second Temple for their rituals. Of course, they were it wasn't quite accepted by the Jerusalem Jews, but I'm sure that they had a lot of these practices that they did, that they performed away from the temple. I wondered how those customs might have influenced after the Second Temple destruction, creation of these rituals.
So great point. So I think that what you're alluding to is there was a temple in a site called Elephantine. And there's some evidence that at this certainly is the case that at this site called Elephantine where Jews lived, they were bringing sacrifices in their local temple as late as the year 409. We have some documentary evidence of that effect. So if what I said before is that the Second Temple is built in the year 515, 100 years later, there still is a Jewish temple in which they're offering sacrifices outside of Israel. Now, if that's the case, so Philo is living in Israel. The text from Philo is being written, let's call it 450 years after the temple at Elephantine. It certainly is possible that there was a continuous tradition within the Egyptian community of bringing something like a Korban Pesach. We don't have evidence that they specifically brought a Korban Pesach. There's another text from Elephantine that talks about the observance of Pesach, but it's possible that there was this continuous tradition. I think what's important, and I think this is where I think your point is well made, is that there certainly were resources in place during the time of the Second Temple that the rabbis could capitalize upon in thinking about how Judaism could move forward. And so if there were people who were already bringing some sort of a quasi, let's call it a Gedimi Kulas, some sort of quasi quasi-Korban Pesach, it could be that what Rami Gamliel has done is Rami Gamliel has adapted this practice that already existed, a quasi-Korban Pesach, and has simply said, look, this is something that has been done in other communities, and this is something, therefore, that we can continue doing. So I think that your point is well taken. Thank you.
All right, there are a couple of questions in the chat if you want to take a look.
Oh, I'm having trouble with my, okay.
So, I'll read it for you.
Yeah, no, I got it. Yeah, no, okay, thank you. Last Mishnah, did they eat the food? Okay, so in the last Mishnah, they're waiting until after the children ask the questions before they eat the food. So, you know, so in speaking about them as ritual props, they're sitting on the table before, right? They're not being brought out to the table and then being consumed. They're being brought to the table. They provoke the questions and only later are they eaten, which I think maybe reinforces this point. Why are you bringing out foods that you're not going to eat? You're bringing out foods that you're not going to eat until later because those foods are primarily serving to provoke these questions. How did the Jews of Elephantine deal with the Tziat Mitzrayim while they lived in Egypt? Excellent question. I don't have the answer to that. Our evidence of the Elephantine community is relatively sparse, really dependent upon these few texts that we're lucky enough to have found. Especially the really valuable ones are correspondence between them and probably in the community in Jerusalem. So very good question. I don't know that we can actually answer that question. Any other questions?
Yeah, may I ask a question,
please? Rabbi Finkelstein, it's an honor to see your face on the screen.
Thank you. why can't the Rabbi Gamliel, Hoya Omer Kol Shalu Omer Shlosha Devarim Elu B'Pesach Lo Yotzei Yidechu Vato, refer to Rabbi Gamliel as a king?
Okay, so it is entirely possible that it could. It's entirely possible that the reference to the Rami Gamliel in Parag Yud Mishnah Hay is a reference back to Rami Gamliel HaZakein. And I don't have any evidence that it isn't. The only thing that I would say is that in conjunction with the other practices that Rami Gamliel II instituted, the Kedima Kulas, and what we'll see next week in terms of study of Hilchot Korban HaPesach, it's at least entirely plausible that we're talking about the second Rabbi Gamliel, who now is devising various strategies simultaneously as responses to the destruction. But what you're suggesting is entirely plausible. Certainly can't eliminate the possibility that we're talking about the first Rabbi Gamliel.
I mean, that doesn't the Mishnah almost always, when it refers to Rabbi Gamliel the first, say Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein?
Yes, it does.
They're referred by that name. So when they don't, I think it's a pretty good assumption it's the second Rabbi Gamliel.
Interesting. Yeah, entirely possible. One thing that I would say is that there certainly is a difference of opinion. I think, you know, most Rishonim take the Rabbi Gamliel, the Mishnah Psachim about bringing the one with Tevi Avdo. Most take that as a reference to Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein. There's a machloket in this particular Mishnah, Parak Yud Mishnah Hey, which Rabbi Gamliel we're referring to there. But I think, Jay, I think you're probably right that typically we would expect reference to the first Rabbi Gamliel as Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein. But Rabbi Finkelstein, thank you for the question.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I want to thank you for illuminating Shir. Please, God, we'll see you next week. This evening, Dr. Sokolow, Moshe Sokolow, will be back after last week's Purim vacation on going through the Tanakh and Mefarshim and now on translations. And that's tonight at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow, Shuli Mishkin will be back after her Purim vacation last week at 12 noon. And then our Parsha 8:30 in the evening and then my Shir 9 a.m. on the Siddur Friday morning, and Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15 on Sunday, and then back to Avram Kowalski, part two of our Pesach series on Monday, and Zev Elif, part two at 1 p.m., etc. And then Tuesday, Rachel Danziger and Alex Israel will be completing his 10-part series on Eliyahu Hanavi, and Mark Shapiro, of course, Monday night, and all our regular Shirim. So we look forward to seeing you. Please invite a friend, let people know, and we look forward to learning with you and your comments and suggestions. And thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, thank you.
Dr.
Thank you. It was outstanding. Thank you.
Thank you.